Hello and welcome to Ask Matt. I'm Eugene Cordero, professor of meteorology and climate science at San Jose State and founder and director of Green Ninja. Green Ninja is a California-approved middle school science provider that helps students use science and engineering to solve real-world problems. I'm here with Matthew DeLacio, geology professor from Cal State Northridge and chief author of the 2016 California Science Framework. Matt is a national expert on science learning and was one of three chief authors of California's NGSS standards. I met Matt about 3 years ago, and he generously agreed to help our team at Green Ninja with advice as we created our own NGSS curriculum. Our team learned a lot from our work with Matt, and I thought it would be great to share some of his wisdom and insights with others. So here we are. I'll ask Matt questions about a range of subjects from NGSS and science teaching to professional training and science content, and hopefully we'll all learn more about how to make this transition to NGSS easier and more rewarding for teachers and students. If you have any of your own questions, just send them to info@greenninja.org, and I'll share some of them with Matt in a future episode. We have a bunch of teacher questions today, so let's get started. So Matt, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. We're here in Southern California. We've got fires all over the place. A couple days ago when I was riding home, I'm back up here. It wasn't a couple days ago, it was yesterday. Yesterday when I was riding home, I was trying to pedal away from one big puff of smoke coming from one fire, and then I noticed in front of me there was another puff of smoke coming from a different spot. So we had fire engines going back and forth all throughout the afternoon, and it's been pretty crazy down here.
Yeah, that's really scary, and up here in Northern California as well, we have fires around here. It's a spare the air day, and this weekend looks a little bit scary. So I guess this is what climate change looks like in California, isn't it, Matt?
It certainly does seem to be the case, or at least the beginnings of what it could look like.
Yeah. So anyhow, well, thanks for joining us today. And you know, over the last few months at Green Ninja, we've been working with teachers who have been piloting our curriculum as part of their district's adoption process. And we've learned a lot from these experiences. And I've been collecting questions that teachers have been asking about how to take their own teaching practice and make it more oriented toward an NGSS classroom. So let's start with this, Matt. How important is vocabulary in NGSS?
All right. Well, you'll notice that if you look through what the requirements of NGSS and from what's in the standards themselves and what's in the framework, there's way less vocabulary than there was in the 1998 standards and what a lot of science teachers are perhaps used to centering their classroom around. Obviously, it's useful for us to use the language of science as much as we can, but when it comes down to it, NGSS is about understanding what happened and how it happened and those conceptual understandings. And we try to minimize the introduction of vocabulary because we spend a lot of extra time teaching vocabulary and it takes away from the time from actually learning the concepts. So I like to tell people that vocabulary is useful. It's useful as a label for a concept. So if you have something that you want to describe that's really complicated and rich and it'd be just so much easier just to add a certain label to it, then you can add that label to it, but otherwise we try and avoid that. So an example of that would be if you wanted to describe how water can evaporate up into the atmosphere, rain back down, get soaked into the ground, and do all of these different things. It's a whole lot of words to describe all that, but if I just tell you about the water cycle, that's a really good use of my vocabulary. But there's a classic one from a research paper that I really like, which is the term thermophilic bacteria, which is, if you know your Greek roots, is heat-loving bacteria. You don't save any words by saying thermophilic, and so we don't actually get any benefit from that in terms of things. And so trying to use everyday equivalents as much as possible. The research actually shows that that can actually help us not just understand the science at our level, but when we get to higher levels and we need to start using more advanced vocabulary, we actually end up doing better and our students end up doing better if we skip the vocabulary and save it until later. And that's been shown in a number of great research studies.
Well, that's interesting. And I remember well one time, Matt, when you were helping us and we were talking about the Coriolis force, which is, you know, related to how things spin on Earth because of the Earth's rotation. And we had started our lesson with the discussion of the Coriolis force, but you encouraged us to think about the phenomenon of how it impacts weather on the planet first. And then maybe at the end, you might, you know, label this thing, you know, people call this the Coriolis force, but to start with really what was going on.
Yeah, vocabulary can be an add-on, but should not be the starting point or even the destination.
Yeah, and kind of following along with language, here's another question that comes up pretty often, and that is that many of my students are English language learners, and their teachers are looking for ways to help them, and they're asking about sentence frames. Are those helpful in an NGSS classroom?
Yeah, they're hugely helpful for bringing students along the way and seeing kind of what our expectations are for them. There's a number of resources that show sentence frames related to each of the cross-cutting concepts. You can kind of really illustrate, blank caused blank, and I know this because, and you can really introduce this whole way of thinking and put that in there with a sentence frame. And just like any other scaffold that we have, we like to start off with the using them and then weaning our students off of them as they get more sophisticated and more around that. So, you know, in an ideal world, I think we see a lot more of those sentence frames in the elementary grades than we do getting into high school. But that's the ideal world. In our practical world, especially as we're trying to implement NGSS kind of in the middle, and we have a lot of middle school teachers who are out there who are teaching kids that have not done much science at all in the past. And so we're going to be using those sentence frames to help us along the way. And absolutely, a lot of teachers very successfully have those posted on their walls to help them with their discourse. And I think they're a fantastic tool for us to not be afraid of and not feel like, oh gosh, that's too juvenile for my middle school or my high school students. And definitely not. We use them whenever they can be powerful.
That's great. Yeah, I've seen some teachers using them in the classroom, and they look really helpful. Here's a question from a district admin, and this has to do with in particular when a principal might come into a classroom and they're trying to determine whether NGSS is happening in the classroom. And are there any tips that you might have for a principal to determine whether NGSS, when they come into a classroom, hopefully to coach teachers, not necessarily to evaluate them? But do you know of any resources that might be helpful to district people about how to see whether NGSS is happening?
Yeah, well, like many other things actually in science, is that it's not a binary thing. Is NGSS happening or is it not? There's a progression. We talk about this with our students. There's a progression of understanding. Yeah, it's not that you get it or you don't. It's how much do you get it and what aspects do you get? And so the same thing is true with our teaching. An administrator is looking for evidence of NGSS, we can go to that wonderful place of the progressions. I don't know if you remember, we've talked about these before, but within the NGSS appendices, there exist these sections called the progressions that say, what does it look like to be doing data analysis in early elementary? How does that differ from upper elementary, middle school, and high school? Because, you know, when we say we want our students to be able to understand cause and effect, we mean something different when we're talking about elementary kids than we do at high school kids. We need to be moving to a higher level. And so early on in implementation, I think a lot of the teachers that we were working with a couple of years ago, when they saw things, they might take to heart those cross-cutting concepts and those practices. They might try them, but they would kind of be throwing their kids the wrong level, not quite sophisticated enough or too sophisticated. And so this is where those progressions really become helpful. It means that if you're looking at your students trying to understand, I'll use that cause and effect example. In elementary school, they're simply trying to say A causes B. In middle school, we start seeing that maybe there's some things that have multiple factors that are causing them. We want to be able to put those things together. And by the time you get to high school, when you're talking about cause and effect, you're talking about really rich and complicated processes where there's feedback mechanisms, for example, like in climate, where what causes global warming? Is it carbon dioxide being released into the atmosphere, or is it the warming of the atmosphere that actually triggers the melting of permafrost, which releases more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, which warms things up, and you get these really rich, complicated things where cause and effect is not quite so clear cut, if you will. And so if I'm an administrator, I want to be looking at where is my teacher along that? Are they simply just asking their kids, you know, did A cause B? If they're in high school, that's not where we want to be.
Yeah. And like you said before, you know, at the first few years as NGSS is rolling out in different districts, we may have to be a little bit further back than we hope. But, you know, the intention is that in 10 years, you know, when students are getting cause and effect in kindergarten and first and second, that by the time they reach the higher levels, they've had, you know, years of experience thinking about that. And we'll start to see those practices and those cross-cutting concepts develop in there at the kind of more age appropriate time. And I like to tell teachers that'll be really exciting, but the first few years is going to be, you know, it's going to be more bumpy.
Yeah. And similarly, a lot of teachers tell us, you know, my students can't do this. They haven't done science in so long. And I think the advice that I do is, okay, well, then go back one stage on the progressions. If that, you know, there's no point in trying to, you know, even though it says you need to do this in middle school, that's our standard. That's what we're trying to reach for. But if they're, you need to get them to move up along those progressions. And if they aren't at that level yet, then you need to go back one level and maybe you can move faster so you get towards there, but we need to be moving upwards and not just simply, you know, striving for something that's simply impossible because our students just don't have the background.
Yeah, I really like that spiraling in NGSS where, you know, we keep coming back to these practices and cross-cutting concepts and even the disciplinary core ideas with increasing sophistication. So we hear a lot about hands-on activities and their value. What does that mean? What does a hands-on activity mean to you, Matt?
Ooh, yeah. This is something where my students are actively trying to puzzle and figure something out, perhaps using real-life manipulatives, perhaps using a simulation in the computer, perhaps just trying to really dig into something with their you know, where they're in charge of doing something. So maybe student-centered is part of this and not just hands-on. Those are kind of two things that maybe go often in parallel, but not necessarily. So, yeah.
Okay. And then how often should we be doing hands-on activities in a typical NGSS classroom?
Well, there's, you know, we want our students to have buy-in to the learning. And so we want to make sure that they have opportunities to do that where they have some sort of experience. And particularly when we're talking about NGSS, we talk about phenomenon, a phenomenon that they're trying to puzzle out and understand and explain. And one of the useful things about hands-on experience is that they happen in our classroom such that all of our students can get to the same level of having seen that phenomenon. Otherwise, if we're trying to talk about something that's going on in the real world completely, they may have different levels of understanding and different levels of background with that. And so it can be really useful to do those hands-on activities. But once you've got that and you're starting to puzzle things out, you need some time to actually do the puzzling, if you will. So we can't just do hands-on, 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 and one activity after the next. We need a lot of time to think things out. This is where that minds-on term comes in. You need to make sure your students have some opportunity to put their minds on part. And so we discussed this as a kind of a rule of thumb for us that it could be useful to have maybe a third, a quarter of your lessons, a fifth of your lessons, somewhere between 20 and 30% of your lessons are the actual hands-on part. But it takes so long to really construct meaning out of things that once you've got that experience and you're trying to figure out what it means, that takes the rest of the time and the majority of the time. So, you know, given in a given week, you might have one or two days of hands-on activities, and the rest of the week of those 5 days of lessons is all spent trying to circle around to that hands-on activity and what happened.
Yeah, that's. I think that's a question that comes up a lot, and that's what we're striving for is to give them that experience and then give them the time to be able to figure out, you know, how these things work that they're grappling. And here's a direct question from one of the teachers. She says, I'm piloting a new program for my district, but I'm finding it hard to assess student learning when many of the students haven't had science since forever. How do I assess a program when the students coming in are very weak in science?
Yeah, I mean, you're trying. Is the question about trying to figure out sort of strategies for figuring out their students and assessing their students, or are they trying to assess whether or not they like this new program?
Yeah, I think it's really about this new program in there. And, you know, the program is at grade level, but the students aren't really there. And so they're like kind of like in this two worlds, like, of course, they want to help their students. But they're supposed to be evaluating this program.
Yeah, so I guess that the first thing that you're looking at is there's always going to be a range of learners in your classroom. And so if this material doesn't have the flexibility to meet different levels of students in any classroom. And maybe you're saying that it's because so many of my students haven't had science in forever that all of them are shifted towards that lower end. Then we need to have that flexibility, and we need to make sure that we have those supports for those students there. And if they aren't there, then it's probably a curriculum that's not rich enough for you to teach in a real world classroom, even the ideal real world classroom of the future, when all these students come in with better NGSS background. We still need to have that flexibility to deal with the students at a range.
Yeah, or that at least you acknowledge that that's a gap in this particular curriculum, and whether you want to support that through some other means or find something else that better suits your district's needs. And I think that's one place that a lot of teachers are kind of thinking about. And then, you know, I know a teacher in a small district who was teaching a fourth grade self-contained classroom, but he's now been moved into a middle school and he's teaching math and science. And he's got familiarity with math, but not with science. And he told us, you know, I like science, but I've never felt very prepared to teach middle school science. And his district gave us some funding to support him throughout the year. What suggestions do you have for us for how to support this new science teacher who is kind of thrust into this classroom because he has a good rapport with these students, but he doesn't necessarily have a background in science?
Well, the first thing is, of course, that one of the main indicators of how successful this teacher will be is this teacher's self-efficacy, how much they feel like they can do this. And so we need to make sure that we're supporting not just their content knowledge, but also their confidence in this. And really a lot of what we work on is, especially when I'm working with elementary teachers, is teaching them that it turns out that, you know, you just need to be excited and curious with your students, and that's really a first ingredient to things. And that the research actually shows that you need less content level knowledge than you think you do to successfully teach our kids. It's the pedagogical content knowledge is that fancy term. And an experienced fourth grade teacher that has a good rapport has a lot of the pedagogical content knowledge aspects. So they have the pedagogical part, and they probably have some basic science understanding, but maybe need a little bit more of that specific disciplinary core idea world. So, you know, what I like to recommend for somebody like that is that you'll get the most bang for your buck if you really invest your time. And kind of one of the best ways to do that is to go back to school. It's a lot to ask of somebody, but really getting in an environment where there's other teachers, other faculty members and things, and going back to a program that cohorts a group of teachers who are in a similar situation. I know that CSUN, Cal State Northridge, we've got something like that for science ed, and a lot of other schools do too, knowing that a lot of teachers want to come back and get master's degrees, and a master's in science ed is a possibility for some of them. And so that's the pie in the sky thing. Barring that, finding high quality summer activities where you can really invest your time uninterrupted if you don't have that full structure of a whole degree program that kind of motivates you, then finding something where you can really carve out time in the summer is really valuable, and something that's not just for a day or two, but a couple of weeks to really dig in. And that those sorts of opportunities are really valuable for teachers. And I can tell you from our experience providing such things to teachers that the other thing that this teacher needs to know is that it's going to take more than one of those summers for them to get to the point where they really feel like they're making progress and implementing these things and really understanding what NGSS is or what science is. And, you know, it could take, from our research, we show it takes about 3 exposures, if you will. So that could be a year-long thing and 2 summers, or, you know, that's quite a bit though. And that's when we really start seeing our teachers take off and really grow.
Well, I think that'd be interesting for administrators to hear too, because, you know, especially with elementary being in many districts under science, you know, like that many of the elementary school teachers don't feel prepared, or they've been pressed for time in terms of how much time they spend on science. Some of the districts we're working with are suggesting they're going to support science instruction much more strongly in the future. But it's also important for them to realize like what kind of investment they need to make in their elementary school teachers.
Yeah.
So you're suggesting, you know, a 2-week summer program and some interactions during school year and reflection and teams and all those things.
Yeah, it really does take quite a bit, and not a lot of districts and not a lot of teachers are able to access those resources to make that happen. So we limp along doing the best we can, listening to podcasts to help grow our minds.
Yeah, well, but those teachers, you've told me about some of them, after they get those experiences, you really see a big shift, don't you?
Oh my gosh, we see them, you know, we host an NGSS Palooza here at CSUN every year, and it's coming up in November, actually. And this year, our faculty, we have a huge faculty team, but none of us are presenting sessions at this because we had so many teachers that wanted to volunteer now. This is the first time this has ever happened. We usually had one or two teachers that wanted to share something. And this time we have literally, there's 15 sessions, I think, that we're running, and none of us as faculty members, we're just kind of like, do we need to go? we've replaced ourselves, which is an awesome and wonderful feeling.
Yeah, that's where you want to be. So let's now turn our attention to climate change and the environment, where we review some of the latest news in this area and talk about how to bring such topics into our schools and classrooms. So as we know, climate change is in the news every day. We already talked about it at the beginning. I was recently giving a talk at the Climate Summit at the CSTA annual meeting in San Jose, which just happened last week. And during the Q&A after my talk, one of the teachers told me about her frustration in getting access to real-world climate and environmental data. You know, the data sets out there seem to be very complicated in various formats and also hard to find. And yet, you know, in the framework, it talk a lot about using real-world data. So do you have any suggestions for folks who are looking for good data for their classroom?
No, I can definitely sympathize with those people. As any PhD student in science knows, a huge fraction of their time is spent moving data, converting it, and getting it from one format to another, and trying to, you know, get into this program and then out to the other program, and that requires quite a bit of expertise that we do not want our teachers to be having to spend their time on. So I certainly feel that, and it's really hard. So I'm hoping that, to be honest, that this comes on the responsibility of people like you and me, Eugene, that we're supposed to be putting together data sets for our teachers to use that are rich and accessible. And it's just too much to ask of a poor teacher to go and do that. But with that said, finding a few of the real-time interfaces to real-time data, that sort of thing is very valuable to have. And so we have to find the good interfaces that people can get just simple stuff from. And I don't actually have a list of that, but maybe that should be on my to-do list to get those together for our teachers so that they do have real-time data accessible to them. I know there are quite a few links in the framework to some of the best data sources that I had when I was writing that. So be on the lookout for those, but I certainly understand that there's a lot more room for improvement on this avenue.
I had a very similar answer to the teachers who were there. I was like, I know it's hard because, you know, the data comes in all these different formats and different resolutions, and yeah, it's complicated. But
and even units that don't make sense if you're not familiar with that particular area of, you know, teachers, you know, it's very, there's lots of data out there. There's so much good stuff that you could get access to if you knew what you were doing. But it's really hard.
Yeah, it is. And I agree that's more of our responsibility and as a curriculum provider to try to make those, to do some of that heavier lifting. In a side discussion I had with some other teachers, they asked for suggestions about how to handle students who think that climate change is a hoax. And this is one of the fears that some or challenges teachers have, is they're going to talk about an issue like climate change that now is fairly politicized. What suggestions do you have for teachers?
Yeah, well, there are a number of resources that the teachers can go to find sort of some common things that people will have in their heads that they've been told about climate change, some common myths about climate change, and you can read about those. And maybe I don't know if Eugene, if you have a favorite, do you have a favorite of those?
I mean, there's a few of them. There's one about, you know, I'm trying to blank on the name. I'll come up with it and we'll put it in the notes. It's Do you have one in your head, Matt?
That's exactly. I'm blanking on too. I've gone to several of them in my past, and that's why I asked you. I was hoping that you'd remember, but we'll get them.
Yeah. Oh, I think it's about climate skeptics being skeptical about. Oh, yeah, it's climate skeptics, and it's run by some climate scientists, and they kind of review some of the main. Anyhow, we'll post it in our notes for sure, everyone. That one has.
Skepticalscience.com is indeed a good place with the most used climate myths right on the left side. There we go, the internet here. And so, yeah, it has a number of common arguments. And so if you are faced with those sort of pseudoscience statements, it gives you a place to go and learn a little bit about things. And I'm looking at the website right now as newcomers start here. And you can basically look at things, I believe, even with different levels of sophistication of the responses. So if you don't know as much, there's the basic level and the intermediate level answers and the super advanced answers for those people that really want to dig into those from a deeply scientific approach. But you can get different levels of things. So that's a starting point, is to arm yourself with some of the knowledge of what your students might say and what the professional scientists say about those things in response. So that's one thing, but also trying to figure out the right tone and level of respect, and just remembering how all of this ties into the NGSS practices and looking at, we're all trying to discover things. We're not just accepting them. So let's look at what the data say. That's always what we do as scientists, is we always look at what the data say. And so if somebody tells you that, it's the sun that's causing it, then we go back and we look at what the sun's done and we get the data for that. And there are actually some nice activities that you can find that actually look at the effect of solar variation on climate. And that's an example of real world data that somebody's already put together and synthesized for people. So just really trying to go back to the practices and go back to the data and say, let's look at this.
That's a great point. And when I was asked to speak at CSTA last week, that was the one thing they wanted me to talk about, was how do we know that humans are responsible? And we looked at the radiative forcing chart so we could quantify the impact of solar variations versus carbon dioxide or ozone depletion and all those things. So I like that. I think that's, we could look at some reputable sites like NASA or the EPA, but we also will kind of rely on our own understanding and maybe do a claim evidence reasoning argument around some of these topics. So anyhow, those are good pieces of advice. So let's finish up on a topic we both enjoy, and that is burritos. And in some of the Green Ninja videos we've made, I've been cast as Dr. Burrito. And in the first Dr. Burrito episode, I end up using a fancy burrito meter to determine the carbon footprint of different types of burritos based on their ingredients. And no, it was not my intention to become a YouTube star, but since I do like burritos, that's how I got cast. But Matt, if students wanted to explore the carbon footprint of their own burrito, do you know any resources that we could provide or any directions we could give students?
Yeah, so you're thinking about the carbon footprint of a food. Whenever we're talking about actually carbon footprint, we use this term life cycle analysis, which means that you're thinking about the full life cycle. So if you're thinking about a bean, it has from its very birth, it starts off as a bean, perhaps is maybe a way to think of it. And then you put it in the ground, you have to add water. Adding water requires often pumping water, and so there's some carbon footprint associated with that. You might add a fertilizer. It could either be an organic one, or it could be a chemical fertilizer. Either one is going to take some energy to move that fertilizer and put it out in the fields, and the farmer's going to have to do that. Then it's going to grow. It's going to take in some carbon as it's growing. It's going to be harvested, and then they're going to take the leftovers and dump that and turn it into compost, and there's going to be some exchange of carbon with the atmosphere and in the process of breaking down that bean. And then you take that bean, maybe you're putting it in a truck to take it to some processing plant and get all the shell off of the bean, and you're left with the bean, but you have to use some energy and the machines to do that, and then you're driving it again to some other place, and they probably cook it, and that uses some energy, and it finally gets into a can, and you need some energy to make that can, and you can go on and on and see this, the whole life cycle down to the point where you are digesting it, and maybe it gives you some flatulence, maybe that's going to have some greenhouse gas exchange with the atmosphere, and so looking at from the beginning to the end. Now, this is too much for a middle school student to undertake this whole process of even a single food product from beginning to end on their own. So they're going to have to go to some resources where other people have done these. And in particular, there are a few good scientific research studies about different foods that really try to make sure that they're using the same methodology from beginning to end. That's the problem, is that you can't just go and pull out, oh, somebody studied beans and they looked at things. Remember, anytime you're looking at a system, you have boundaries, and maybe they chose to include certain things and not include other things. I mean, if you go to a different research study to look at your lettuce, they might have included different stuff, and you're saying, oh, look how beans use so much more carbon than lettuce. But if they're using different methodologies, that might be the source of it. So you have to go to a single place that's done a good job of trying to do this across many different food types. And there are a couple of good studies. I can send you a link of one of my favorites. And in fact, actually, lettuce tends to be a pretty big carbon footprint thing, partly because it also is wasted so much. We waste lettuce a lot, and so much of the carbon footprint of that just goes to food waste. So looking at those things and really trying, you know, a student that wanted to research this would really perhaps just be exposed to that whole process and really being thinking about that whole system that's going on there. And just studying that would be a fantastic way. And you'd be doing that from the practice of obtaining, evaluating, and communicating information. That's I think, the practice that would work best for this particular task.
Yeah, and that's just one ingredient, but it kind of opens up this whole world of seeing, you know, the life cycle of a what might seem like a relatively simple ingredient.
Yeah, and you're thinking about food, and if you're thinking about your carbon footprint, you not only have to think about the carbon footprint of that object, but thinking about how many calories that gives you. And, you know, lettuce tends to have a high carbon footprint per calorie, but we don't eat a lot of calories of lettuce usually. They're very low. They're very low in calories. So, you know, they don't necessarily contribute a huge amount to our carbon footprint overall, even though calorie per calorie, they show up really high. And so if you're trying to find you have to figure out what basis of comparison you're going to use for deciding this.
Well, maybe in the links below, we'll provide one other. There was a website called Bon Appetit Carbon Footprint Calculator, and they have some burrito calculations there too. I do believe it's from some peer review studies, but it's like you said, you know, people use different methodologies and where they start or their boundaries makes it super complicated. So I look forward to the day when you could just attach your phone to some burrito meter and you could just touch this thing and it would tell you the carbon footprint of everything, although I don't actually think that'll ever, or how we're going to ever get there.
Yeah.
But I think that's a good place to stop for this time. And so thanks for joining us at AskMap, where we explore NGSS, science education, and the environment with education expert and nice guy, Matthew DeLacio. Thanks, Matt, and we'll see you next time.
Absolutely. Thanks, Eugene. Bye-bye.